22, tout monde, antenne, corps étrangers.
This may have been the starting point, but it wasn't the final stage. That's just a theoretical starting point, a conjecture. We don't even know that's true. We're just basing it on observables. Black men, African-American community. That's theoretical, but technically we do not know where these beings came from. As I said previously, this is a world within itself. Okay, we could take on human form, but in this particular world, human form was left at the door, and you took on another guise, spiritually. So, this information that you read here is more or less for the man on the street to give him a better understanding of the origins of things.
Hydra Decapita now is 8 years old for you both, so it's not exactly a new work, but looking back on it, it seems to me that one of the things that's very strong in this work, that's in your practice as a whole, is an idea of speculation. And here we have the presence of speculative fiction, but there's also a very different idea of speculation that comes in through the story of the Zong massacre and the link to insurance. So I was wondering if you could maybe start by telling us a little bit about the genesis of this work and how that idea of speculation and speculative futurity operates within it.
First of all, it's great to be talking about this work in this context. The presentations today have been kind of amazing and compelling in many ways, and have really kind of opened up new ways of relating to this work. To respond to your question, there's a kind of a long-standing engagement with the work of Drexier, this trio whose work really means a lot to, you know, to now a couple of generations of practitioners. For those of you who don't know, Drexier were a duo, two African-American electronic musicians who lived and worked in Detroit and who made a number of recordings between 1992 and 1997. And then in 1997, they released their first album called The Quest. And then they released a number of successive albums, one called Neptune's Lair, another called Harness the Storm, and their final one, Grava 4. So they were two, an older man called James Stimson, and the younger man called Gerald Donald. And in 2002, James Stimson died. And so this was the end of Drexier as a duo. And Gerald Donald continued and makes recordings as Doppler Effect, who some of you might know. And what was unique about Drexier was that all of their records, all of their CDs, all of the songs, all of the titles, all of the artwork comes from a specific world, a specific science fiction or speculative fiction, or what we called at the time a sonic fiction. And this fiction is set in a world called Drexia, and they are called Drexia. And what their recordings do are imagine the geography of Drexia, and they imagine the people, the Drexians, who inhabit this underwater world. They imagine the weapons that the Drexians, who are quite militant, they imagine the weapons they have. And they released, and they also did no interviews, and there were very few photographs. There were just these records. Once a year, a record would come out. And in 1997, they released this first album, The Quest, and this album gave something like a myth of origin for the entire Drexia project. In this album, The Quest, on the inside of the CD, there was a map, a series of maps, which began with the slave trade and then went through successive phases and then ended up with techno leaving Detroit and covering the world. And there was a short text from a figure called the Unknown Writer. And this text imagined and spoke about a world in which mothers were thrown overboard during the Atlantic slave trade, during the Middle Passage. And it said, imagine that the mothers who were thrown aboard, the pregnant mothers, did not die, but instead gave birth to a new, a new species of mutants called Drexians, who could live underwater and who could breathe underwater. And imagine the implications of this underwater realm of these beings. So this was the key, the codex to all of the records that Drexia put out. And since that time, many artists have responded to their work. Ellen Gallagher, many artists. And so I was writing about them as a music critic in the 90s, and we were always discussing Drexia. In fact, everybody we know is a fan of Drexia. You can find them everywhere. Just last month, there was a long article on Red Bull Music Academy, which is this well-known music platform, a 10,000-word article explaining the whole mystique of Drexia. Because there were no pictures or images, they were totally mysterious. This is before the internet. At a certain moment, we always wanted to make a film in which this kind of what people now call an Afrofuturist mythology was at stake. And so when the invitation came to make a new work, we decided to make this video, Hydra Decapita. But the key was not to explain, it wasn't to explain the Drexia mythology. It was somehow to wrap a second speculation around it and to connect the Drexia mythology to different moments in history. Drexia themselves never talk about the case of the Zong. We kind of understood that you could make a relation between the case of the Zong, which briefly, for those of you who don't know, was a famous massacre in 1781, in which the English slave ship, the Zong, which had taken slaves, several hundred slaves from the west coast of Africa to the Caribbean, ran into trouble because it ran out of water. And the captain of the Zong decided to throw overboard 131 or 132 or 140, the numbers differ, decided to throw over more than 130 slaves over a number of days. And then when the Zong ship came back into Liverpool, The consortium of slave owners from Liverpool who owned the ship made a claim for insurance, saying that they were owed insurance because the slaves were their property and therefore were cargo. So instead of the slave consortium, instead of the captain or the crew or the consortium being tried either for murder or for accessory to murder, on the contrary, there was a dispute over marine insurance. This was the dispute. And this was a case in 1783, and sure enough, the slave owners won. They won the case, and they did get insurance for the loss of their cargo, i.e. for the murder of 131 slaves. In 1783, the news of this trial came to the attention of a British abolitionist called Grenville Sharp, and also a well-known ex-slave abolitionist called Olardo Equiano. And they brought the news of this case to the attention of the British media, and this case became famous in the British news. It was famous because actually this kind of marine insurance claim actually happened all the time. But there was something about this case, the sheer blatancy of it, the sheer impunity of the slave owners, that somehow caught the attention of the British public. So what we wanted to do was, in a way, make a connection between the story of Drexia as this fiction of the afterlife of slavery and the marine insurance case of the Zong. And behind both of these was the financial crash of 2008, which was ongoing in 2009 and 2010. And what we wanted to do was try to understand the financial crash in terms of a long duration, going back through the Atlantic slave trade. So we wanted to argue that the Atlantic slave trade was the beginning of globalization and was the beginning of the financial market. So in the background of this film is this kind of analysis of the relation between finance, insurance, death, and speculation. And this was the starting point for the video. Whether that's what we ended up with is another question.
The whole surface of the sea, included in the picture, is divided into two ridges of enormous swell. Not high, nor local, but a low, broad heaving of the whole ocean, like the lifting of its bosom by deep drawn breath of
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about how Turner came into it, because you sing this quite amazing adaptation from Ruskin's description of Turner's painting, Turner's slave ship painting was first exhibited in London at a moment to coincide with a big abolitionist conference. So from the beginning, it was very much tied to the abolitionist cause. And yet when we read about it in Ruskin, that's nowhere to be found in terms of how he approaches the painting.
Mm. Well, first, vocality is kind of central to our practice. So we experimented a lot with voiceover. And I called upon the spirit of Alexander Stewart, of course, who did many of Chris Marker's voiceovers, because I loved the way she almost sang a voiceover by speaking the poems so with so much rhythm and so much consistency. So I used to be a singer. I suppose once you're a singer, you always are. Your voice just gets bad, I suppose, or a bit rough from smoking and talking too much, whatever, not practicing. But I was interested in... I've always been interested in songwriters who have very complex lyrics, and I wasn't interested in singing anymore about, say, emotions or feelings. Became more interested in singing philosophy or theory. I thought that might be an interesting thing to do. And then when we started thinking about how to construct this project, we thought of singing. We thought of doing a song over instead of a voiceover. Then the story with Ruskin and this representation of, and his involvement in the anti-slave movement, but the limits of his expression, let's say, were enacted in another way at drunken parties by William Morris, who would sing Ruskin and get up at dinner tables and start singing some of Ruskin's very highly detailed writings on this painting, on the painting that Turner painted, Slavers Throwing Slaves, what is the title again, I forget. Slavers Throwing Slaves, Overboard During a Storm, Typhoon Coming On is a very interesting,
the Sandra Perry show.
Yeah, Typhoon. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is that the serpent, the many-headed hydra, is the father of the many-headed hydra is a storm or a typhoon or a tempest or a hurricane. His name is Typhon, and basically, that's very interesting because the many-headed hydra is this creature who represents disorder, who represents a creature who of misrule, who will destroy the Herculean kind of mythos that the architects of Atlantic economy and the architects of imperialism and empire created. This laboring figure who would bring development and knowledge and, to the world through the labor of creating empire, creating that these the architects of this Atlantic economy created this figure who was, and then this figure, Hercules in the myth, as we all know, has to constantly lop off the heads of the Hydra of Lerna, this multiple-headed creature who regrows their head. And this kind of represents the difficulty of imposing order on an increasingly globalized systems of labor and therefore insurrection. A body of people is what the Hydra represents, one that threatens misrule, the misrule in the form of strikes, the misrule in the form of mutinies and so forth, and protests. So the the so Turner, you know, I think in this painting, I mean, of course, Turner's dealing with the ocean and dealing with light in so many ways. When you put it through a lens of analyzing Turner, I think as a anti-slaver or as someone who is tracking the maritime trade or the technology of trade and the ocean, he becomes a very interesting figure to think about, I think. But with this film, we wanted to create a number of limits. One of them was to represent the sea in any way that would be... well, Turner's done it. We know he's done it. It's in our heads. The other was the suffering black body being whipped again or being thrown overboard or being, you know, any kind of representation of a suffering body seemed for us to just confirm the absence of thinking around this subject more intensely. So that was something we wanted to completely avoid. So we limited ourselves to thinking about light on water and the refraction of light on water and the surface of water, which ends up becoming code in the film, but you can talk about that.
It looks almost
like... Sorry, I went round.
The surface of the water at a certain point almost comes to look like scribbled handwriting or something, but it always remains indecipherable. So it seems like there's a kind of play in the work between the ocean as some kind of space of inscription, but with traces that are somehow remain illegible to us.
I mean... you can see it's structured very, it's very reduced. You can see you have long shots, but with no sky. And then you have extreme close-ups with the lens focused in a particular way so that all of the movement of the light on the water jumps out at you and starts to signal a kind of broken calligraphy, something that seems to be signifying but never quite does, a kind of apophrenia. You can read into it all kinds of ideas. And then the third are the static shots of a kind of cave. And this is the film. It was as reduced as we could make it. And so what is at stake is a kind of binding, the binding of this kind of epic research that we'd taken on, the Atlantic slave trade, finance, the necropolitics of insurance, but how to convey these without talking heads, without reenactments, how to convey these with the limited means that we had and how to make these limited means open up a kind of an encounter and how to keep an intensity. And so this is part of what explains this continuous permutation around a small number of elements.
And I guess the other main element that we haven't spoken about yet is this figure of the transcriptionist, transcriber. Another maybe speculative aspect of the work that I think it was Aisha earlier spoke about, you know, an ocean archive. And it seems like here there is a kind of absent archive that this figure, mysterious figure, is working from. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, this narrator figure, her name is Novaya Zemlya, which is Russian. It's Russian. It means new earth. It's the furthest point of what was the Soviet Union. It's where the Soviet Union detonated one of the largest thermonuclear bombs known to mankind, a bomb called Bomba, in fact, B-O-M-B-A. That's Novaya Zemlya. And so the idea is that Novaya Zemlya is she returns to these archives and she begins to read and transcribe them, but she comes from a world in which reading is a forgotten mode. So she comes from some kind of future world in which people do not read anymore. And the reason is because reading is a mode of possession. And so she does, in fact, become possessed by what she reads. So she clearly is a proxy for us. But it's also just another way of wrapping or stacking a second fiction around this question of Drexia and the Zong, rather than explaining either, so that you're somehow grappling with her response to the question of Drexia, who is figured in this mysterious voice that comes from the cave, who only goes by the name of Remnant of a Hydrogen Element. That's actually what he calls himself. And this figure, I think we can reveal it now after 8 years. This figure is, in fact, Gerald Donald of Drexia. And he, in a way, entered into the spirit of the film by placing many constraints on us. So we could not film him. We could not film where he lived. We could not use any Drexia music. There was nothing we could do apart from use his voice. So in a way, he was forcing these constraints on us and obliging us to bind ourselves to certain kinds of to this kind of permutative, variational, rotational aesthetic.
Imagine a sphere of water orbiting a star. It's thousands of miles in diameter, maybe 2 or 3 times bigger than the Earth's diameter. So theoretically, these liquid planets can't exist in this realm. So speculatively speaking, this Oceanus Sindor to and fro is actually a journey between marine species from the home world to another world and back again. So actually, when you leave this liquid planet, you are enclosed in a liquefied craft to ensure that the sustained life between the two points and come back again. Imagine it's a large volume of water, and you see a water drop fall off. So this is how interhydratic travel was done. Liquid planets in a star system.
One of the things that I think I was really interested in Hydra Decapita is exactly, Angelica, what you brought up, this idea of refusing the talking head, refusing the suffering body, to instead kind of pull back and find other oblique modes of approach or more abstract modes of approach. And maybe to tie to Louis's kind of question earlier about this bifocal perspective between the Middle Passage and the Mediterranean. With the contemporary Mediterranean, we're dealing with a kind of slightly different question, because there is the possibility of documentation as it happens. Some of those conceptual problems remain there, but we have kind of access to lens-based capture in a way that we wouldn't, you know, with historical episodes. So this is maybe like a more speculative question that is not specifically about Hydra Decapita, but more about this question of an ethics of representation or an ethics of opacity. How do we deal with this in, you know, I think the tremendous amount of images we see circulating today coming out of migration in the Mediterranean?
I mean, I just want to say something very quickly, which is about, again, this idea, like I was saying, we were talking about yesterday in terms of Edouard Glissant's writing on opacity. Opacity isn't a dark space where light is shut off. Opacity reflects back. So one can reflect we can choose our we can choose to think about representation in a more complicated way, by kind of putting ourselves behind this opaque lens, I suppose. But I think for me the haunting figure in this creature in the cave, or this figure from beneath the sea, the Drexian figure, is this figure who can come up to land and drag us down and take us with them. I mean, this is in fact what the Drexians do. They, we met the actual artist who created these Drexian figures on the album covers of this electronic music group, Drexia. So we met Abdul Kadim Haq recently in Athens, and we're going to work with him to bring some of his paintings from that time, but also newer paintings. But I was talking with him, and he was saying how these figures would come up to land and drag the living back into under the sea. So I think the sea becomes an unconscious space as well, the space of the unconscious. The middle passage is a place of gathering, a gathering unconscious, a gathering of all kinds of different elements, economic, the dead, the drowned, the recently drowned, the dead from this period, which probably constitutes over millions of people, in fact. So I think we can, by allowing that space to remain, let's say, what is in the middle of this many-sided film, because I think of when we make work, we think of our work sculpturally in a way, and almost to allow people to think about the place that is unspoken inside it, so they can think from that point. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I think you know, we've seen a number of compelling examples of how to engage with, you know, the contemporary crisis of forced migration. Clearly, Lorenzo Pisani and Charles Heller's Left on a Boat to Die project clearly is a project of a kind of a project of forensic aesthetics, which mobilizes a navigational perspective on the frame and on frames within frames. Both Margarita and Aisha's projects in their different way also open out this question of how to image a mass phenomenon. But I would say what is at stake in all of these is the question of, you know, of what counts, of what counts and what is accountable. And accountability. I think the voiceover says at one point, you know, how to assign responsibility in a context in which the sea itself is weaponized as a criminal entity which tries to dissolve accountability. And just in the context, I just want to draw everybody's attention to something I myself did not know about, which was that, you know, in England, slavery was abolished in 1833 for some people, but not all. It was abolished, you know, in the British Caribbean, in Mauritius, in South Africa, but not in India and not in Ceylon, which is now Sri Lanka. But what I didn't know was that in 1835, just 2 years later, the British government, paid compensation to the slave-owning consortiums. So the same people who owned the Zong, they paid compensation for abolishing slavery. They paid compensation to the slave owners, and they paid them £20 million. And in order to do that, they had to make a loan from the city of London, from two famous bankers, the Rothschild and Montefiore. And in 1835, £20 million was 40% of the government income. The equivalent today is 300 billion. That's how much they paid out. And what I didn't know, and maybe what nobody knew until this year, was that the government, because they borrowed so much from these bankers in the City of London, the government used taxes to pay back this loan, and this loan was not paid off until 2015. That means the British public, that means us, anybody who lives in Britain, has been paying off this loan to the bankers who loaned the government the money for compensation. We've been paying it since from 1835 to 2015. The British people have been paying back this 20 million pounds, which is now actually 400 billion pounds. So this is what, when Sadir Hartman talks about the afterlife of slavery, this afterlife of slavery and the political arithmetic of that slavery can be actually calculated in quite countable and calculable terms. So the nexus between insurance and finance and death is by no means a historical question. On the contrary, it is ongoing, and it implicates the whole of the British public. So that means my parents, you know, and my grandparents and their parents, who all settled in Ghana, and Anjali's parents, and us living in London, Louis' parents, Aisha, anybody who's lived in Britain, anybody has been paying off this debt. So I think that, you know, and that was only revealed through a tweet in February 9th. That's when it came to light. A tweet by the Treasury of the British government was released explaining this. Until then, which of us knew? Which of us can stand here and say we really knew this was actually ongoing? So I think that's one scale, you know. And then the other scale, just one more thing I wanted to draw attention to is there were many compelling books that we drew on for this research. Like a lot of us here, we think with many theorists and many historians. Anjali was quoting from Peter Linebauer and Marcus Raedecker. And there was a book which actually came out after the project, but which clearly relates to it, by Christina Sharp, who's a well-known African-American feminist, called In the Wake. And in this book, she talks about, she quotes a historian called Anna Gardulski, who tells her about this notion of residence time. And what is residence time? Residence time is the amount of time it takes for a substance to enter the ocean and then leave the ocean. So all those slaves thrown overboard in the Zong in 1781, and all the slaves thrown aboard since who have salt in their blood, Anna Gardulski tells Christina Sharp that salt has a residence time of 260 million years. That means the salt of those slaves is in the Atlantic now and will be for another 260 million years minus the years of 1781. And so Christina Sharp concludes, she said, what happens to the energy that is produced in the waters? It continues cycling like atoms in residence time. We black people exist in the residence time of the wake, a time in which everything is now, it is all now. And there she's quoting Toni Morrison. So between this time of the debt, you know, the time of 1835 to 2015, and between the residence time of 1781 to 260 million years from 1781, these are the kinds of expanded scales upon which to think through some of these questions. And I think these make these make our questions both, you know, they make it both entirely implicative, and also the questions of the interscalarity that we've been discussing. These, I think, are shared across all of the projects today, because the scale of thinking through these things demands something like a revision of aesthetics, you know, which to me entails, in a way, you know, in a way, a kind of dissolving of aesthetics and then a rebuilding of aesthetics at a different scale. And maybe, you know, Haida de Capita, in its own way, kind of intuited that it was necessary to both open up and to open up the scale and to change the frame, you know. It in a way it was striving for that, you know. And that project is still, it becomes more necessary now, not less.
Thank you. Maybe it's time to open up to the audience, their comments or questions.
Je vous remercie infiniment pour cette vidéo, et en la regardant, je ne pouvais pas m'empêcher de revenir sur l'une des scènes que j'avais rapportées hier matin concernant une scène de mutinerie dans un bateau négrier. Et ça me fait revenir aussi sur l'un des enjeux des problématiques artistiques qu'on a essayé de discuter au cours de ce séminaire, lequel voulait voir aussi comment traduire plastiquement des données de recherche dont on dispose sur certains aspects de l'histoire, notamment par rapport avec la scène que j'avais évoqué dans le fragment, où j'essayais de prendre la dimension du cri et du murmure comme possibilité possible pour travailler plastiquement des questions par rapport au son. Et aussi, je voulais revenir aussi par rapport avec la question d'une certaine esthétique de la politique, et aussi une question de politique de l'esthétique. C'est-à-dire que je pense qu'au cours de nos discussions, on a frôlé cette question, mais sans pourtant la développer un tout petit peu. C'est-à-dire, parce que moi, j'avais parlé de scènes marronnes pour montrer que j'ai lu ces espaces-temps comme des espaces de subjectivation possible, c'est-à-dire où des corps pouvaient faire un usage libre de leur corps, et offrait aussi également une certaine possibilité de la capacité expressive du corps, et qui redonnait par la même occasion une nouvelle configuration sensible de l'espace plantationnaire. C'est plutôt une vision très théorique, mais plastiquement aussi les limites que nous offre le cadre, les limites que nous offre par exemple l'image aussi, nous permet aussi de comprendre comment jouer sur cette double face politique de l'esthétique et esthétique de la politique. Je ne sais pas si je suis un peu clair, mais...
Absolutely. I think in a way we can understand Haida de Capita as a certain kind of maroon cinema, in the sense that maroon cinema does not mean images of runaways. This would not be maroon cinema. This would not be a fugitive cinema. What would it mean for cinema to be in a maroon relation to cinema itself? I would say that the kind of Hollywood films that Erica mentioned, these are the films that our film is in a relation of cinémarronnage. We're in a relation of cinémarronnage to Amistad and these kinds of films that Erica talked about. And what this suggests is that you can have cinémarronnage through an image that is totally still. Yes, the image of the cave, there is no body, there is no running, but I would say this is an image of cinémarronnage. The cinémarronnage is not a representational image of a body running through a forest, No, the Cine Marinage is an image which refuses a certain kind of representational demand and looks away in order to return another kind of image. So we could now, you know, when we look at this video, we can say it was an experiment in Cine Marinage.
But also, you know, London is a port, and it is full of the people who worked in this Atlantic imperial economy. You know, these were what is described as the motley crew. You know, the motley crew, you could say, were made up of the Chinese Lascars or the Irish or Native American Indians, runaway slaves or slaves who had managed to free themselves and stay. Or, I mean, you know, the history is incredible. In fact, I think this is really well depicted recently in a really good TV series where the East India Company is cast as a really demonic figure so brilliantly. Tom Hardy plays this fantastic character, and it's all about this kind of history. It's called, and all about a slave ship. It's called Taboo, which is really brilliant. But what is really well depicted in this TV series is you know, the port, is that London is in fact a port, and London is in fact a place where competing piracies are taking place. East India Company is the biggest pirate. He kind of casts this very much in the kind of light of Buckminster Fuller's little book called Operation Manual to Spaceship Planet Earth, where he talks about the ocean and wind and the history of sea trade. In a very interesting way, and he talks about piracy in that book. And Taboo is very, very, it brilliantly kind of casts London as you know, a place where all these people are mixing and all these people come together, marooned in London in some way. So I think of this history of a kind of maybe you could call it a cine marinage. You could always also look at it as a mutant cinema. Where people have always congregated inside this idea, whether consciously or unconsciously, as kind of in some way mutants. And this mutancy is a denationalizing mutant body. It is not one, it's not, you know, it is not committed to any nationality. It has been brought there by force or by necessity. So, I think this is also it's where we're from, London, and it is also the kind of energy of the city that people, you know, seem to forget, especially in this moment of Brexit and the rise of the fascists.
It was more a comment than anything else, but I was talking during the break about translating what's legible as diffractive spatializations of racial capital and slavery. And the comment that you made about salt, you know, if you look at the main landowners now in Australia who have the biggest pastoral companies and often own the mine next door to the pastoral companies, they're all, you know, it's predominantly British, Dutch, more and more Chinese. But you can map many of those people back to that 1835 moment when, you know, people need to park their capital, and it gets parked in wool farms in South Australia at the exact moment that I was talking about in the film. And also this situation with that capital moving through the mines back into the ground, like salt is the main... You know, apart from the radioactive stuff and apart from the toxification of water, and after the sheep have salted the earth from the damage that the sheep's feet do on the ground in a country that's not supposed to have sheep feet on it, salt is the dominant ruinator of the ground from the fracking industry. So there's kind of like material transfer is just so extreme. Yeah, I really appreciated this you know, space crossing materialism that actually complexifies the images that are available. And this, you know, the slave from that brick of land that I was talking about that is never real but completely legal conceptual, the image of this slave figure, you know, has so many different informal kind of angles or whatever, but one of them is the Aboriginal stock person. So the guy who didn't want to leave his land, who hung around and took rations, you know, small amounts of food for rounding up cattle and sheep. This image is an assimilation image. It's like the settlers use it as proof that Aboriginal people, you know, had livable experiences in the pastoral industry. Those people were on, you know, zero money, 30% in the 30s, 60% in the 50s. In around 1970, there's a equal wage case that basically finally rules that the stockmen should be paid the same amount of money. And of course, they all get sacked from the pastoral industry. And so there's hardly any Aboriginal stockmen in the pastoral industry anymore. But this, you know, the legibility and complexity of how that money ripples through different spaces, I think, is really interesting. And I think it's also what's not, you know, there's so many ways in which that complexity is lost by tracing materials. And I think what I really like about your work is that it refuses to do that. Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, when you think how the problem that blackness poses for Hollywood, right? The way in which historically and continually blackness has posed a problem for Hollywood in the way in which Hollywood has historically not only committed cinematic crimes against black people, but you know, the actual techno aesthetic assemblage of Hollywood finds it difficult to actually encounter the entire continuum of blackness, so that Hollywood as a racializing assemblage it's not that Hollywood has found black people problematic, it's that blackness problematizes Hollywood, right? Blackness problematizes cinema and problematizes cinematography. And Fred Moten, as usual, a figure who I quote a lot, he has, as usual, a wonderfully eloquent way of putting this. He says, blackness is the post, he says it's the prehistory of the post-cinematic. That's how he poses it. So this notion in which blackness always already had a problem, or always already problematized cinema, and always spoke to something that cinema could not capture, but was always running after, you know. So cinema as a slave master, continually running to catch up to blackness, which is already left before it. So we know that you know, the Lumiere brothers, very soon after works leaving the factory, the Lumiere brothers started making racist films. You know, long before Birth of a Nation, you know, by then, you know, Birth of a Nation just scales it up. So this is really, you know, we can return to the fundamental, the building blocks of the cinematic apparatus and see how blackness posed a profound problem. And in a way, this is for you know, a lot of us here who are theorists, who are making videos with theory and thinking theoretically. It's not that we do the video and then someone else does the theorizing. No, they come from the same impetus. You know, the question of blackness for us, in its broader sense, is compelling to us because it continues to profoundly problematize visuality, visibility, capture, recognition, identification, all of these processes that try to govern that try to govern through making a world that inclusively excludes blackness. I think this is part of the reason why a lot of us continue to return to these questions, because what Naam Chandler calls the problem of the Negro for the problem of thought takes on a specific question as soon as it comes to the moving image. The moving image elevates this problematic, and I think a lot of us have just begun to grapple with these questions, you know. So in a way, everything we've been exposed to over the last couple of days have been experiments in problematization.
Okay. So I had a question, but I am going to rephrase it as a comment, as Olivier has asked me to. So I guess I want to come back to this point that Erica made about the sort of image of the water that looks like it's inscripted text, right? That's almost text, but not text. And thinking also about the sound, which is also on this kind of not quite decipherable language, sounds like a radio frequency that's lost. And I was thinking in a way that, for me, that was the most affectively moving moments, in a way that's where I put my emotional response to the film, was at that moment, those moments. And I was thinking about that in terms of it being a kind of form of testimony. And I guess my counterpoint to thinking about that was thinking actually about this project by Forensic Architecture on these drone bombs in Waziristan. And thinking about how one of the problems that they had, and when I'm thinking about testimony, right, like thinking about the construction of testimony, how one of the problems that they faced in trying to gain a visual evidence of a certain building that had been bombed was of the resolution of satellite images. Right, and this is something that Eyal talks about a lot, Eyal Weitzman talks about a lot, is this kind of threshold of detectability. So he says that deliberately the satellites are configured at a resolution so that probably about the size of the square on the ground, that it cannot see information at that level, which is precisely the dimensions of a human body, right? And so they kind of build a story at that threshold of detectability. And I know your work is coming from a very, very different sort of, you know, set of references, but I was thinking about that particular register of your film as kind of hovering on what Forensic Architecture would call the threshold of detectability. I'm trying to make this not a question, but...
I think that's an awesome parallel. Sorry, I think that's an awesome parallel. I mean, you know, we have the... In a way, we get a, in a way, the greatest homage we can pay to Forensic Architecture is by not making forensic work. And you know what great fans we are of Forensic Architecture. So yeah, I think this notion of the threshold of detectability and the threshold of a detectable testimony, and the threshold of what Morton Feldman calls crippled symmetry. You know, I think all of that speaks back to that incredible moment you began with, Erica, with Roland Barthes' notion of an a-signifying C. You know, because maybe what Hydra de Capta tries to do is to say, you know, it's a-signifying but not quite. So it's the intimation of signification, but that gets cut by something else, you know, which is what Aisha's pointing to. So now, you know, testimony and detectability enter into this notion of a-signification and complicate it in some way.
I just wanted to also say that this film, Hydra de Capita, was part of a trilogy of films actually on the sea. One was a film we shot here called I see infinite distance between any point and another, which was a film about the poet Etel Adnan and her reading her book, Sea and Fog. It was a challenge again, how to film a poet reading, a challenge that actually Jean-Luc Godard posed to the world or to himself. But this film was one of them. And then, so why did we make that? Because she so beautifully describes and so beautifully describes the kind of precarious nature and the poetic nature of the sea. So the threshold of detectability is so explored in poetry. I just wanted to... the other film that we made relating to the sea is The Radiant, which was around Fukushima on the tsunami. So, but that's a whole other story. I just wanted to read, actually... because the last time I think we were in Paris for any seriously long period of time, we were here making that film on Etel, and she's so old now. I just wanted to read something she wrote about the sea from the film, but from the book. She writes, "Morning, morning, vast imprecision. Fog has covered everything in grey, absolute. This has lasted. Doubt looms over the mind. Absence is harder to accept than death." And far darker than this, in the book, "A cosmology of terror, history's recurrent theme of tortured bodies dumped as garbage. We believe in the uniqueness of these times as in the originality of this sky." You know, I don't want to put the idea of the threshold of detectability at the... I want to give it back to the poets, you know, because this is where it lies. Also, I just wanted to say, and I don't normally do this, but it's something that we are quite excited about. Koja and I are having this mid-career sort of retrospective next year in Holland and at the Van Abbey Museum. And I think that's when you'll be able to see for the first time probably a lot of these films and their kind of relation to each other. And also we're going to be working on this theme of salt quite precisely and many other things. So that's just for next year. So anyway, I just wanted to say also thank you to Olivier, Louis, and to Philippa for this... incredible invitation. I think this has been the best invitation that we've ever had to Paris. And to thank Kieran as well, because he's just such a brilliant organizer and so such a great host. And thank you to
Thank Erica. You to